The Obama era has begun. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Are we expecting too much of our new president and his cabinet officers? Our number is 1-800-478-8255, toll free. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at APRN.org. You heard the speech. What do you think about it? Alaskans went to the inauguration this year in great abundance. Talk with them and your fellow Alaskans today about our new president on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
So a young man in Miami wrote a column for the paper about the new Obama administration, and he's saying, what did you expect, basically? He's saying a Southern kid never thought he'd see this day. Just think of what I grew up with. And he was talking from the context of someone who, in 1968, was in high school. And he pointed out that it's mostly been disillusionment for his entire life. And now he sees this optimistic moment, and he has some hope. Well, where do we stand? You know, it was 41 years ago when a black man ran for president of the United States. His name was Dick Gregory, and his party was the Peace and Freedom Party. And he was running because of the Vietnam War, because Martin Luther King had been assassinated, Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated, and Democrats were left with Hubert Humphrey, and Republicans had Richard Nixon. And people that wanted to see the war end needed somebody else to vote for, and there was Dick Gregory. And lo and behold, my guest was running for office with the Peace and Freedom Party in the state of California that year. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John Blaine.
Thank you, Steve. That was a long time ago.
It was. I think a lot of people listening to this show weren't even alive.
That's
at
right.
That time.
That's right.
But it was pointed out by Juan Williams yesterday that, look, you had Shirley Chisholm, you had Alan Keyes, you've had these, Jesse Jackson and Dick Gregory. He did bring up Dick Gregory. He said, but the difference with Obama is that he actually could get elected. And those other ones we knew all along couldn't.
What did Joe Biden say about Obama? Anyway, yeah, I was back from Nigeria. I'd worked for a while in Los Angeles. I ran into a guy that just impressed the heck out of me, Jim Woods, who started Studio Watts Workshop. And he asked me to come and write grants for him because I could speak English and he had great ideas. And we turned out to be a heck of a team. He was a black guy from Houston who had come to Watts, actually had come to Southern California and done a degree in economics at SC, and then opened a little storefront in Watts called Studio Watts Workshop and was there during the riots, and his place was not burned.
So what year were those riots? Was it
66. I wasn't there. Bernie and I, my wife and I, were in Ghana, in fact, in 66, 67.
So you were among the first of the Peace Corps people.
Right. I was in Peace Corps 7, the 7th group for Nigeria. In 1960, I graduated from UCLA. I drove my old Studebaker up to San Francisco, and I got a job parking cars at the Shadows restaurant. And all the other people, all the other guys at the Shadows were there kind of as a semi-career and had flower shops and other places. And a friend of mine said, who'd been there and did this as a summer gig, said, why don't you come down to the YMCA camp at La Honda? And in a way, that moment sort of led to virtually everything else I've done in my life, which is kind
really?
Of amazing.
Go ahead. How?
Well, I got down to La Honda, this wonderful place up in the trees up in the hills between Stanford University and Pescadero, and got a job, you know, just being a maintenance man. Pretty soon I met somebody who was running the winter program, which was the San Joaquin County Schools Outdoor Education Program. And I said, can I get a job teaching? And he said, sure, when do you want to start? Do you have a degree? I said, yes. He said, when do you want to start? And so within 6 weeks, I was teaching sixth grade in Manteca, California. And while I was there, well, everybody looks around. I mean, everybody's got to have a mentor, it seems to me. And I was looking for a mentor. And the guy who had actually got me the job there in Manteca was an early mentor. He asked me if I'd like to come back and run that outdoor education program, which I did, for the next year. And that
was... So you go from being the teacher to being the boss.
Yeah, that was kind of fun. I went from being the maintenance man at the YMCA camp to being the person who told everybody this is what we need and this is what we have to have, and running around all night long, it seemed like, because we had sixth graders as the campers, and then we had high school seniors, boys and girls, as their counselors. And me and a couple of the teachers and a couple of the folks who ran the outdoor education program sometimes would find ourselves running through the hills at midnight, chasing the kids back to their cabins.
I would think.
But the thing that happened about that time, I was wondering what in the world am I going to do, and Mankiewicz came to Cal Berkeley.
Frank?
Frank Mankiewicz.
Ha!
And gave this.
He ran NPR for a while. Frank Mankiewicz
did. He did. He ran a great program, but it didn't take care of the budget, as I remember.
Right. He thought they were going to make a fortune on the internet. He was just early.
Right. Anyway, I heard him at Cal, and I actually, he was there talking about the Peace Corps. And I went up to him afterward, and I said, can I be a Peace Corps volunteer? And he looked at me, you know, like a great father and said, of course you can.
Young man.
Yes, you can. So that's how that got started, and I went to UCLA for the training program and then found myself in Nigeria in January of 1963. We were in training, in fact, at UCLA when the Cuban Missile Crisis was going on. I remember wondering if this were real or if this were just another kind of overdrawn political event, and realized as we got to the end of that moment that it was more than just another political exercise. Wound up in Nigeria, taught there from 63 to 65, and that was, of course, when Kennedy was assassinated. And it didn't strike me. The grief didn't hit me until I got back home. But anyway, my life has gone on from there in several different directions, but it was all as a result, really, of going to San Francisco this before the Summer of Love and finding somebody who said, why don't you try this? And I tried that, and then I tried something else, and I tried that. And in a way, it relates very much to my family. My older brother was born in 1933, and he went to Korea during the Korean War. I was born in 39, and I went to the Peace Corps in Nigeria. My younger brother was born in 46, and he chose not to honor the draft and was found guilty of draft evasion in court and given 2 years probation. And so in a way, the three of us represent kind of generational change that's occurred to me through my life. And now here I am, 70, and looking at my grandchildren and realizing that new generations beyond those of our children are out there ready to take over.
Well, yes. And you wonder if they will. I mean, one thing that Obama said in his speech, and apparently he said before, is this is a moment that will define a generation. a moment that will define a generation. And along with that comes a call to action, a call to what he called responsibility. And you just wonder. I mean, you just wonder, is that generational power really there? I don't know. I'm not part of that patch, and neither are you.
The thing that I wanted him to say this morning was, and I know he's going to, he kept on saying, you know, we've got to all take responsibility. We're all responsible for this economic mess we're in. It's not just the greedy few who seem to skim everything off the top, but we're all responsible. And what I hope for from him is the kind of leadership that says, oh, yeah, I can do that. Oh, yeah, I can do that.
Well, that's the way the crowd seemed to respond, though. They seem to have that sort of response. At least that's the early reports we're getting.
Well, I've never seen so many joyous faces. It was incredible.
Yeah.
Everybody was just happy as they could be. And I think we as a nation are ready to be challenged. I remember how horror-stricken I was when George Bush said to the country after 9/11, go out and buy something. That was his call to action. Go out and buy something. Oh, Lord.
Well, it's fact of the matter is politics has gone to not the best state. I mean, it's not a place that the best and brightest amongst us have not chosen politics as a career for quite some time now. And we're dealing with the results of that. And the question is, what happens now? You know, will the real leadership potential come out in the younger generation? I have absolutely no idea. I have no idea whether the commitment will be there, because it really is a commitment. It's a commitment to civic responsibility, and it's something that's been eroding. I don't think there's any question about it. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. It's Talk of Alaska. And we're talking about the new Obama administration and civic engagement. And we're ready for your reactions. And we got one from Jeff, who responds by email and says, my favorite part of the inaugural was the prayer ending with this poem, "When a Red Man Can Get Ahead, Man." He said, where does that come from? I'll have to say, I don't know. I don't know, but I liked it too.
It comes from that song. Who sang it? If you're black, step on back. If you're white, you're all right. Wonderful.
Somebody will call. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK. My guest is John Blaine. In 1968, he ran as a candidate on a ticket headed by Dick Gregory. I don't know if Dick Gregory was the first black man to run for president. Probably not. Probably not.
Probably
there was somebody
not.
In Socialist Workers or someplace.
Sure.
Most likely. But the first one that I knew about. So did you win, John?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
I don't know
what
why.
Did you run for?
Well, the way I happened to run for Congress in 1968 was that I really wanted to be a part of the California Assembly. I ran for the Assembly about a year before in the Peace and Freedom Party. Bernie and I were living in Los Angeles. I had worked at Studio Watts Workshop. I decided that there was a special seat that, something happened and the Assembly person was not able to fulfill the term. So there was an open election in my district, and I had been involved in the Peace and Freedom Party just because it made sense to me. I mean, it was trying
to
help
peace
people.
And freedom. Yeah.
Yeah, it was about peace and freedom, and it was during those wonderful Nixon years, and so I.
Now, when you say Nixon, you mean Nixon, California Nixon, not Nixon, President
right,
Nixon,
right? But the thing that really surprised me years later was to find out that one of the people that came around in a suit, I used to hold community meetings, and the meetings were for the purpose of anybody who wanted to come to the meeting. I tried to advertise them as broadly as I could, and the press was really pretty good at it. It respected the Peace and Freedom Party along with the other parties. In fact, La Raza Unida was the other splinter party that helped the Republican actually win. But this guy in a suit would come around and give me money in an envelope, just cash money, and sort of look scared. I don't know. Look kind of like he was so totally out of place.
Wow.
And I had no compunction whatsoever about taking the money. I needed the money. I could use it for all sorts of things. And what we did was we had these wonderful community meetings, and whoever came up with the idea that was the most viable, we thought, as a political point, was turned into a flyer. That idea was turned into a flyer, and we printed 10,000 copies, and we littered the streets, put them on cars at markets, and stood on street corners and did that kind of thing. But the one thing that really came out of that that made a difference to some people, at least, was that was soon – this campaign took place soon after the earthquake that hit Southern California. It must have been in 1967. And there was one office that FEMA, whatever was FEMA at that time, had put up out in the western part of Los Angeles where people could go and fill out the forms for earthquake relief, you know, cheap loan money or grant money. And the people in central LA didn't even know that such money was available. So we put out a flyer. We said, you know, people should know about this. And they actually opened an office in central Los Angeles for people to go to and fill out those forms to get that earthquake money.
Well, so who did the guy in the suit turn out to be?
Years later, Bernie and I were in Seattle. I was working at the Seattle Arts Commission by that time. And I got a letter from the attorney general? No, who was it? What was he then? But it was Mr. Brown, who turned out to be the governor of California later. And it was – I wish I had kept that letter so much. It had the big gold seal of California on it, and it said, if you admit that you were part of the dirty tricks, we will not prosecute.
So what was the dirty trick?
The dirty trick, well, the guy that was giving me the money was part of the whole the dirty trick business that was going on.
Well, why was he giving you money?
Because they wanted the Peace and Freedom Party, of course, to gather as many votes as possible because they had an idea that maybe the Democrats would suffer by that.
Oh, I see. So you were kind of like the Ralph Nader.
Well, I was, in a way, yes. Give money to John Blaine and the Peace and Freedom Party, and he'll – we wound
up – Well, did the strategy work?
Well, it did.
Aha. So you lost the election, and the Democrat lost the election.
That's right.
Aha.
It was me and Raul Ruiz of the La Raza Unida Party, who took about 7% of the votes, and that was enough for Richard Alatorre, who went on later to be a political leader in California. But Richard Alatorre lost the election in our district, and the reason he lost the election was because the Democrats had taken it so for granted. And our little campaigns, which left me devastated, by the way. Yeah. I really felt I was going to win. I don't know what happened. But anyway, allowed the Republican to win, and it was a classic campaign. This Republican had his house fired on maybe 2 or 3 days before the election. Bullets went through his window. He came, you know, and said, I'm all right. I'm okay. And I will go forward with this. He was elected. I don't even remember his name, but I know he didn't fulfill his term because it was found that he was connected with drug money from South America. That happened.
Whoa. Yes. Some wild and woolly days.
Indeed.
Well, I guess we would call them, it was a sketchy political era, I guess I would say. How do you feel now seeing Barack Obama becoming the president of the United States? How does it make you feel about your involvement back then? Is this some fulfillment of your hopes, or what's happened to us? How do we get here from there? It seems so far.
I think that the For me, the most important thing about his election in terms of any personal reaction or feeling is that my children have an opportunity to be invigorated, inspired by somebody that they truly care about. During the early parts of the campaign, I would talk with our sons, and my attitude, frankly, was, you know, he's not much different from anybody else. And I realized that part of my lack of deep enthusiasm for Barack Obama was a fear that he would not make it, a fear that he would fail. And I didn't want to be disappointed. You and I went through some pretty enormous disappointments when people were assassinated right and left, when our dreams of something better were really pushed around and bloodied and turned into a pulp, and we watched our country go in a direction that certainly wasn't the direction we had felt it was going to go in and wanted it to go in. And so I was really, really happy that my sons never gave in to that lack of enthusiasm. My sons were behind Obama from the beginning and felt inspired by him all the way through and were able to feel the joy of having, you know, got behind somebody at the very beginning and watched that person grow and develop and win and become president. I haven't talked to them today, and I'm looking forward to it because that's a sweet thing.
Well, there are some very transformational things about it. One of them is the money. The ability to use the internet had – Howard Dean had some of this, but Obama eclipsed everybody in terms of voluntary contributions from people, repeated voluntary contributions from people to the point where he had vastly more money than the Republican candidate.
$750 million, I think, was
vastly
raised. Just incredible. Unbelievable.
And that's one that I – you know, it comes to my mind. There's probably other ones that are transformational. And transformation seems to be what it's about. Let's go to Leo. Joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Leo.
Good morning to the panel and the host. Today's an exciting day. Now that there's new Senate and new Congress and a new Obama administration, it's my hope that the new government would recognize the veterans that were promised their GI Bill and their GI Montgomery Bill. Promises made and promises not kept, you know, and there's a lot of homeless veterans out there and jobless veterans, and those are that most that are not educated because of that 10-year limit, and most of which we have experienced PTSD, the post-traumatic stress syndrome, downfall, and it's both in wartime and peacetime, and that 10-year period is way too short for any veteran. And Alaska being 68,000 to 70,000 veterans in Alaska, you know, we feel like we've been left out. Without crumbs, it's a good day to feel that difference made today.
Leo, thank you for that. And I don't think there's any question but that you're right about that. That has been happening, and we just have to have some hope that it'll get addressed a little bit more realistically.
And thank goodness for the changes that are made. You guys have a good morning and a happy new year.
All right, Leo and Bethel, thank you so much for your call. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the civic engagement in the Obama era. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. So, John Blaine, you have continued a path of civic engagement Peace and Freedom Party was not even the beginning of it, as you've kind of explained. Probably the Peace Corps was, but even before that, you had a kind of an inspiration to get into this educational thing. Do I have that right?
You got it right. When you asked me to come today, I thought a little bit about what in the world has really influenced my life. And it's been those mentors that I talked briefly about. And I have a feeling that most of us look for others to give us that kind of inspiration, that mentoring that we need in order to fulfill something in us that we can't quite articulate. I know that's been my need and my delight, because I've had so many mentors in my life that have given me a kind of purpose and direction that I think I could not have found by myself.
So tell me again about this this Watts guy from Texas.
Jim Woods, just an amazing person who had an understanding of street smarts that went beyond anything that I'd ever come across before. I'll tell you one story about him. He started what's called the Watts Chalk-In. And the Watts Chalk-In was simply he and me and a couple of other people getting out in front of Studio Watts' workshop in the early morning and making 36-inch squares out of chalk on the street. And then inviting the community from far and wide to come and draw pictures on the street. And some of the pictures were fantastic, and some of them were childlike. But people would come. The streets were shut off, and people would just come and look at each other's work and so forth. And I said, Jim, God, what a great idea. You really are an art person, aren't you? And he said, you crazy. What do you mean an art person? I don't bring them here to look at the art or to make art. I get them here to look at the street and see that there are cracks in the street. I get them here to be painting a picture and looking next to them, and they see a black guy. And they say, oh, my God, this guy's black. What am I doing? Look at that. This guy's yellow. He said, that's what I bring him here for, not to put those stupid pictures on the ground. So he had these purposes that went so far beyond the immediate, the apparent, and I loved him for that.
So was that one of the reasons why in Peace and Freedom you started putting out these flyers?
Oh, I think so. I think I had it was his inspiration that suggested to me that ideas come from the community. They come from people who are right there. They don't come out of, you know, outer space or something. Or certainly my ideas are not going to be the ones that make that kind of a difference. But people will come up with ideas that are fantastic. One other thing, and the sense of community. I think that's the other thing that I wanted to have those meetings for. The other thing that Woods did, and he worked hard and long to do it, was create a low-cost housing neighborhood. I don't know how many houses, but there were at least 20 or 30 houses in the Jim Woods neighborhood. They didn't have post boxes. They had a little house in the middle of the low-cost housing development where they had post boxes. He said, if everybody has to come there every day and get his mail, he's going to talk to other people. And that place is going to be a place where people have conversation and look forward to meeting each other.
So he was a builder of what they actually call social capital now. And we actually have a word for it.
Well, and he was a community organizer. I mean.
Ah, yes, community organizers.
Yes.
It's interesting. Obama was a community organizer. I've known many. I'm sure you have too. I mean, just
sure.
at our age, we would. But, you know, most of them, in my humble estimation, tend to be a little bit on the manipulative side.
Well, I think to be a community organizer, you've got to be a good manipulator. I mean, look I'm a Unitarian, and they talk about Unitarians as you know, the minister of Unitarian Fellowship is herding cats. And I think, you know, trying to be a community organizer is kind of like being a herder of cats. You got to have something beyond the ordinary to keep people's attention. You got to make it real.
It's Talk of Alaska, and your call is welcome. We're reacting to the new administration of Barack Obama. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Our guest is John Blaine. He's a civically engaged person and was a Peace and Freedom Party candidate in 1968. And actually, even before that, he's telling us, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Rasmussen Foundation is announcing March 1st as the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Awards grant, which provides funding directly to artists to support their creative work. You can sign up to participate in one of the Rasmussen information sessions to be held the week of January 19th by calling 297-2876 or go online at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This morning in his inaugural address, Barack Obama said that we're going to put aside our worn-out dogmas, our stale arguments, and work together, that I extend my hand and you unclench your fist. A pretty vivid picture he drew, and he's calling for people to work together. It's certainly been called for before. In a lot of ways, this speech was asked not... my guest is John Blaine. John, did you hear the Ask Not speech by John Kennedy?
I did. I was in Berkeley with a friend of mine and listened to that and was terribly inspired. Listening to Obama this morning, it wasn't a terribly inspirational speech, I felt. It was really a very nuts and bolts, not a whole lot of soaring rhetoric. But there was a confidence to him and a call to attention. Pay attention. We must pay attention. And I think he's got our attention. And now I just hope that he uses that attention that he has and that feeling of, we have a leader. We can be inspired by this leader to help us move in directions that make sense. I was going to talk a little bit about, remember the CETA program?
Sure.
Comprehensive Employment and Training Act.
Oh, yeah. I got money out of that.
You did?
Oh, I had a CETA job for a while. You bet.
What'd you do?
I trained people to do news on the radio.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Well, I was in Seattle working at the Seattle Arts Commission, and we used the CETA money to hire artists, and I think what we did, and I'm looking forward to programs that I think are going to come back again, like the art program, the WTA, back in the Depression, where artists, their murals are particularly still in great evidence across this country.
Yeah, we did a program where we were talking about what is real economic stimulus? And we actually had a caller that brought that very thing up and said, you really can get someplace investing in people.
Yes, we can. Well, Seattle, back in the 70s, I was there from 72 to 78, and I was the head of the Seattle Arts Commission. And that was the first 6 years of the Seattle Arts Commission. And what was done there to stimulate a good feeling about living in Seattle, I think, has continued to this day. The 1% for Art program was started there. The Bumbershoot was started then. The CETA program hired – we even had a guy who wrote an opera. We had poets who wrote poems that were put on the buses. We had, of course, artists in the schools was a part of what we did. We had artists in residence. But
it seems that there is a sort of an artistic mass that can be accumulated. That maybe it takes the seed money or something to get the people started. But often when they get hooked, they just have to keep being engaged in that artistic field, but they need to get that initial impetus, you know, like you start a band and you got your day job and you hope for the kind of gig where, you know, you can make money just making your music or, you know, whichever it is. But there's that push that starts it, you know.
I don't know how many artists in Seattle came to me during that process and saying, you know, this is the first time that I've ever felt like I was for real because I actually got paid for what I was doing. That was one of the things that we insisted on at Bumbershoot, too. Artists are seemingly, and I think it still goes on, constantly asked to contribute because they love their work, right? But they still have to put bread on the table and still have to be paid. So we just made it a policy that every artist who was performing or involved in Bumbershoot was paid. Sometimes not a whole lot, but they were paid.
Yeah. I think that's your phone. Let's go to Stephen, joins the program from Heidelberg while John turns off his cell phone. Welcome, Stephen, to Talk of Alaska.
And good morning.
Good morning.
Talk of Alaska and John Blaine. One thing I like about what Obama said, it's coming from a person that most likely would never have been elected president. And you know, we've all had our turns in those valleys of tears. One thing I like about it is it has promise. And, you know, the one thing I didn't like about this last month was the bailouts of those banks and car companies. You know, we throw money at it. You know, we have bankers getting outrageous salaries, and our people, we the people, you know, the poor people, you know, they should have poured money into those small businesses. You know, Congress and America is going through tough times. And we're kind of lucky to be in Alaska where, you know, Alaska has gone through those those tough times when in the United States when they went through those hard times where, you know, Mr. Guthrie sang those songs about depression. And we've come a long way to this point in time where we have to according to the Romans chapter 13, we have to honor our government and our leaders, and we have to. They're not there by accident. George Bush was not there by accident through 9/11. And America is in a horrific war, and not only that, there's an economical war, and we've got to wonder why we got there. We got in this recession and depression, and rethink our positions. And you know, one thing I like about Governor Palin is there's a woman there in office, and she's there for a reason. And we have to. Maybe those veteran allotments will get finished this year, and they've been waiting 45, 50 years for their allotments. And the promises America holds, you know, and we have talk of Alaska, First Amendment and 14th Amendment. We must understand that Romans chapter 13, that we do have to honor those, and we have to honor the people's beliefs.
Stephen, thank you. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
It's interesting that you bring up about the banks and the throwing of the money at the banks. There was an article in the New York Times over the weekend that said that, basically reporters went out and talked to the people that were running the banks and said, what are you doing with that money? And they said, we're sitting on it.
Right.
We're sitting on it. It may not make sense to you, but in a business sense, this is the best thing we can do with it. We'd be silly to loan that money out now. we're going to use it for acquisitions. Wow. And there was a line from Obama about the marketplace. You know?
I think it was about the greed in the market. No, he said the marketplace is strong and can lead us to prosperity. But he also talked, of course, about the greed. And I certainly thought about the banks in particular and the insurance people who insure the banks and how they come with their hands out and then have parties and they pay incredible bonuses to the people that are there. And you wonder, what in the world is going on? Who do others really know better than we do about how to use these enormous sums of money to help us to keep from what they keep calling the brink of a terrible disaster for our nation? I don't know.
Well, I think, John, you and I both sit here and just wonder whether people will really respond to Obama's call. I think that's what we basically come down to. He calls to responsibility, and we've seen a lot of, you know, I mean, certainly a very ambitious and difficult campaign that got him there. And then you just wonder, well, so often campaigns have a lot of energy, and then it's time to roll your sleeves up and do the work.
In a way, that's one of the things I liked about his speech this morning. Rather than, taking us on wings of angels, he told us that we were in tough times and we were going to have to work to get out of tough times and take responsibility for it. I think this man likes to govern and not just to run for office. I think this man has shown us through his enormous ability to organize things. I mean, yes, we have to thank George Bush for leaving us a legacy of Barack Obama. I've heard people say that that's his greatest legacy. But we have to thank Obama for being able to be elected, able to organize things and present himself in such a way that he could, in fact, come to the place where he can govern. I think this man can govern. I think he wants to govern. I think that he's not just somebody who likes to run for office and likes the spotlight. In fact, I don't think he likes the spotlight all that much. But I also feel that within this country, there is an enormous reservoir of hope that all of those virtually millions of people in Washington, D.C. today show. It's not just the glamour moment. It is this enormous feeling inside of us that, yes, there is. We can. Yes.
Yeah.
And he touched on something that I think there will be an out. I think the best and the brightest, as you put it, and the least bright are going to get together and make something better out of this country than we've had before. I think the idea of, sure, we've got to make the economy grow, but the idea of going out and buying something to support your country is no longer going to be the rallying cry.
Well, the it's been very interesting. The reaction of Republicans has been very
positive,
supportive.
Very supportive.
And we have seen a very inclusive attitude in terms of who he's choosing to bring into his administration, to the point where people say, well, he couldn't possibly bring all these views together. He's going to have to be the decider.
And I think he can. I mean, he gives me that kind of confidence.
Let's go to Jed, joins program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jed.
Yes, good morning. I'm quite skeptical about Peeble, President Barack Obama, and his idea of inclusion, because the two-party system, the Republicans and the Democrats, have essentially disenfranchised anybody who isn't a Democrat or a Republican. They do this at the ballot box by prohibiting or making it very difficult for third parties or nonpartisans or independents from having the same status as Democrats or Republicans. In this state, for example, we have a primary which is paid for with taxpayer money only for the benefit of Democrats and Republicans. And so when Mr. Obama, President Obama, talks about wanting to hear from everybody about solutions to the problems of the country faces, I wonder how that can happen when people are excluded, their civil rights being disenfranchised at the ballot box.
I think it's a very good point there, Jed, because the fact of the matter is that a primary election is designed to find the nominees for the parties, and there's no question but what it benefits the major parties and not the others.
So I'm curious, as a former candidate, what are your feelings? Do we need another Civil Rights Act of 1964 to reflect equality at the ballot box?
Well, it sure would be interesting. I don't know exactly how one goes about it, but that proportional voting has been talked about from time to time. I don't have good ideas about this. I'm just not real creative that way.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Jed.
Well, splinter parties or smaller parties such as the Peace and Freedom Party have had an effect. Ralph Nader has had an effect. It seems to me that we would have been closer to having a third party or having other parties really emerge had Barack Obama not been elected. I think the fact that he was elected is going to keep the two-party system more vibrant because that is such a such an amazing thing that he has been elected.
Well, it's the equation is different. It's a different equation than Bill Clinton had to deal with. I think Bill Clinton was a very politically astute, and he steered the Democratic Party to the center. Now, you know, I think that was to the great discontent of many because it's somewhat of an unprincipled and pragmatic direction, but it was the direction that he saw that the public was going, and so he sent the party that way. We're not there now. We're someplace else, and we're kind of feeling our way as to where we are, and I don't really know, but we're clearly somewhere else when the entire financial services industry is shown to be a complete sham, when it turns out it's really nothing but gambling, and they can't stop gambling.
Right.
And when they they handed that money, they still want to gamble with it.
Right.
And then you see the auto people. And I don't know about you, but I was shocked when I saw the photograph of the executives of the auto companies testifying before Congress. They were not coming there with the hat in hands. They looked like mobsters. They looked like thugs. They did not look like the kind of patrician sort of people that the earlier part of the 20th century would put in charge of their commerce. That's the way I would put it. And so clearly we're at a time now where there is not the faith in the marketplace that there once was. And people can whine all they want about, that's socialism and whatnot. I think we're going to be stuck with some socialism.
Well, yeah, socialism, whether we like it or not, is there. But how does this relate to Anchorage? I mean, that's what I'm kind of getting back to and thinking about. We're going to be electing a mayor. The assembly.
There you go with your civic engagement again.
Well, town square, yay!
Yeah.
One of the things that
you
I
bet.
Think
see,
this election
see if you
does.
Can expand the focus to all of Alaska, though. All right, I mean, think about like we have a huge energy challenge. We have a peculiar electorate situation. What with because all the population is in the in the rail belt, and we have interesting political prospects in the state: a reform governor, a fairly bipartisan legislature, and very strange economic churn going on in the
very
state
strange.
Of Alaska.
Yeah.
And all this is going to whiplash back to your town, John.
Well, a caller earlier today said, our governor is a woman and there's a reason for that. Our governor is a reformer and a person who I think, is trying to redefine herself now that this political campaign is over and is trying to learn what she must do, in fact, to continue that reform governance that brought her into office. And I certainly hope she succeeds. How that reflects, I mean, goodness, it's a scary time, I think, for all of us here, because I was in Portland last weekend with my son and my six-month-old granddaughter and my son's wife. But anyway, we were talking about how Portland was cut off from Seattle because of the floods that were down there 2 weeks ago and how, you know, groceries were off the shelves. And I said, how do you think we feel? How do you think we feel?
Can you, if the boats stopped coming, we'd really be in trouble really fast. You couldn't fly that stuff in fast enough. It is Talk of Alaska. Our guest is John Blaine. We're talking about the first day of the Obama administration as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes.
Yes, the state of Alaska, no doubt, has an interesting role to play in the upcoming national political spectrum. We're not the backwater anymore. It's very interesting. Booking guests for Talk of Alaska, they return my phone call now because it's a call from Alaska, and they're all curious about it in ways that they weren't before.
I think we're pretty undefined, frankly.
Well,
it's an opportunity to define us.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that those of us who live here know Alaska has many aspects of a colony. We've had Steve Haycox on here, author of Alaska, an American Colony, talking about this. It was a very, very colonial situation. The fishing industry comes out of Seattle. All our groceries come out of Seattle. Washington owns most of the land in the state, and it goes on and on. Even culturally, it's difficult to have a commanding sort of mass.
You know, one of the things that gave me more pleasure than anything else about our lovely state recently was that picture of that barn up in the Matanuska Valley filled with carrots. I was delighted. And then I went to Cars, and they didn't have any Alaska carrots. And I said, how can you do this? What are you doing? But that's a good sign, the fact that we do have some agriculture going on, and there is nothing better in the world than Alaska carrots, let me tell you.
I think it's wonderful that the Alaska Grown logo has taken off now. I mean, it's actually become stylish. People want it. There was a copyright dispute about it. It got so popular.
That's great. That is wonderful.
And it does seem people will pay a premium for Alaska-originated products. And this is, you know, hard to tell if this will continue. It'll probably continue to some degree just because of the energy penalty that's being paid to bring food in from elsewhere, which is getting more and more apparent when you go through the checkout line in the grocery store. Mm. And people do start looking towards all sorts of sustainability. It's going to be an interesting time in our community.
Well, and yesterday was Obama called for a day of service. And,
yes.
And the food bank was on the list for one of those organizations that could use your help. And I went out to the food bank and was so impressed, not only with the people, but with the size of the place, but which also suggests that there are a lot of people here and throughout Alaska that need a little help.
Let's go to Lisa, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Lisa. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. I just like to mention that I've been listening all morning, and in the beginning of the talk show, you mentioned how important it is for us to start to think about nurturing our future leadership and how to involve youth so that we can have, you know, adequate leadership in the future when we're in those nursing homes, John. I think that it's real important to say that parents all across, you know, our state need to be thinking about running ideas by their kids, involving them in decision-making processes, discussing current affairs with them. It's so important. And I think that, if we do this, then we don't have too much to be afraid of. It's been real. It has been difficult to even think about trying to even take on a career as a politician, quote-unquote politician, that the very word has a negative connotation to it. Mm. But if we encourage our youth and steer them and guide them and have discussions with them, I think that we're going to be okay. But it really, really needs to be said that when you've taken on a position such as, you know, a politician, it needs to be said. I think I'm not a politician myself. I'm not. But I can see that taking on that kind of role in your community is a sacrifice. It really is. These people sacrifice part of their lives to serve our communities, tribal leaders, you know, corporation board members, city council members in the villages. Those are usually the same handful of people. And those are the people that are cooking 8 dishes for tomorrow's potluck. Or, you know, it just needs to be said that leadership is a sacrifice. And it's an honor, too, to be able to serve your community, from what my perspective is. And I think we need to nurture our youth and encourage them in that way. So thank you.
Lisa, thank you so much for that. I think you've made me certainly think about leaders that I know, and I wonder where they get their energy.
Well, it has
its own reward. It's the little political involvement I've had, it has its own rewarding, to be able to go out there and actually see results, actually know who your neighbors are, actually get them together and accomplish something, show up for a meeting or whatnot.
Right.
You know that. I mean, it does work.
It does work, and it's not all political. I think of my friend Ruth Moulton, who, without whom we wouldn't have Town Square. Ruth died a couple of years ago, and there was a push to call Town Square Ruth Moulton Town Square. We went through a big public process, and it finally turned out that there will be a plaza that will be the Ruth Moulton Plaza, and there will be other parts of Town Square that are named for other people that were important in creating Town Square. But all of those people, you're right, Lisa, it was a sacrifice for those people who kept that dream together and saw it through to completion. It took a lot of hard work and difficult times and going against people who were your friends.
Yeah. It often ain't easy. And yep. I think we're coming into a time where, you know, push is coming to shove, and it's not going to be easy. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, John Blaine.
Thank you, Steve. It was great to be here.
Peace and freedom. I don't even know if the party exists anymore.
You know, I don't either.
But who could not believe in peace and freedom?
I'll have to write Jerry Brown and see if he's still after me.
Yes. Gooseberry Peter at the controls. Duncan Moon is our managing editor. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you so much for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
Tech Cominco and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.